Hello, listeners. I am Eric Filion from the Department of History at Queen's University. This is the fourth of five episodes prepared for Curating for Change, the work that music festivals do in the world, a two-part online conference hosted by the University of Guelph and Queen's University. We held the first part at the end of August. Part two will take place on October 14th and 15th. Our primary objective with this conference is to bring together a diverse set of perspectives to extend our understanding of the work that independent, artist-run, or boutique music festivals do in promoting vital forms of activist arts-based practices, pedagogies, and community making. Today's episode is an interview with Jessica Roda, who joined me via Zoom from Washington, D.C. on September 12, 2022. Jessica Roda is an assistant professor of Jewish civilization at Georgetown University's Waugh School of Foreign Service. She is an anthropologist and ethnomusicologist who has served as a visiting fellow and scholar at Université de Paris, McGill University, Columbia University, UCLA, and the State University of Campinas in Brazil. Growing up in French Guiana in a family of Algerian, French, Spanish, and Sephardic heritage, Jessica Roda is also a trained pianist, flutist, and modern jazz dancer. She is the author of numerous articles and two books, notably Se réinventer au présent, Les Judéo-Espagnols de France, Famille, Communauté et Patrimoine Musical. Sincere thanks to Jewish Studies at Queen's University for making this interview and Jessica's participation at our conference in October possible. So hi, Jessica. It's a real pleasure to have you here today in this virtual space to talk about your research as a preamble to part two of our conference on music festivals. And so thank you so much for accepting my invitation today.
Thank you so much, Eric, for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here today and to talk about my research.
Unless I'm mistaken, you traveled to Poland this summer to do some work at the Krakow Jewish Cultural Festival. I mean, how was your trip and how did it feel to be among people again in a festival setting after really like more or less 2 years of pandemic restrictions?
I think for me, it was exceptional, honestly, to be able to be there to relive in a certain normality, because the streets of Krakow were almost like normal, except that everybody told us it's not as crowded as it used to be. So maybe it was better for us doing ethnography and enjoying also the city. But for people organizing, of course, the festival, they lost a lot of tourists. And also in Poland, you also have the war in Ukraine. So It was also something that was extremely present in the way the festival also integrated certain activities for Ukrainian refugees. And Europe, I guess a lot of people in Europe, with the war and the pandemic, really, there is this need to be together again. I think more than in the past. It was very, very, people were longing for that. And I was as well.
So you said ethnography, you are an ethnographer. So what is ethnography and how does one do collaborative ethnography, which I think is how you describe your work. So how does one do a collaborative ethnography of a music festival?
It's a good question. So I've been working at a lot of different festivals and with a lot of artists. So from France, Morocco, Spain, Canada, and now Poland. What is interesting for me when I talk about collaborative ethnography, it means that it depends on first the festival. So I, for instance, in Montreal, I collaborated with the Festival du Monde Arabe, Festival Orientaliste, and also the Sephardic Festival. And in this case, I was a volunteer. So in terms of collaborative ethnography, it means doing participant observation, being present, being a volunteer, supporting also the festival to promote some of their activities, sometimes to help them for certain funding, to find also volunteering for the festival. When I was in Murcia in a festival Tres Culturas in 2009, So in this case, I traveled with the artist. We were together in Spain for rehearsal. We were backstage. So that was a very different dynamic. In the case of Poland, it was much more the level of the observer for me. And I have my student, Sofia Doreńczko, who did participant observation. I connected her with the team of the festival, and she was a volunteer for the entire time of the festival. And in my case, I explore another festival, a festival that is called Festival, which is an alternative space from the major Krakow cultural festival. And I was much more at the level of observation. So when I talk about participant observation, it's a more collaborative ethnography. It really depends on the space. It really depends on the goal also that I have for the festival. And I would say that what connects my work between all those different festivals is that I'm really interested in looking at the way Jewish identity is represented in all those different spaces and all those different countries, and to think about their connection and the interconnection between all those different festivals, even if the collective memory of Jewishness in France, in Canada, in Poland, in Morocco or Spain is very different. But you also have part of this ecology of festivals and of Jewishness in those festivals, you have a certain interconnection and you have a meaning that is part of, I would say, a global project today. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, collaborative ethnography means to be involved at different levels. And of course, also depending on where I am in terms of my research project, when I started this research on cultural festival and music festival, it was very different than what I'm doing today, going to Poland, where I already have a certain knowledge and I'm going there for different reasons and looking at it from a different angle. Also because other scholars, you know, have approached, for instance, this festival and have written about it. The other important element is the access. What I've done with the Festival Sepharad and Festival du Monde Arabe in Montreal has been very collaborative. I wanted to have access to archives. I really wanted to do a kind of a biography of this festival and to integrate the political aspect of it as well. But I wanted to give back also to the organization to be able to give them a certain perspective of the changes that occurred in the development of their own festivals.
You have referred in some of your work to sites where music making takes place as, and I quote, temporary autonomous spaces. And I really like the term, and I find that it's really helpful in thinking about the work that music festivals do. So what is a temporary autonomous space, and what does it make possible in the context of a festival?
So the starting point of this concept is really the critics of this idea of, you know, the fetish of the representation and this idealistic also moment, right, that a festival can create. And the fact that it's not necessarily representative of, you know, especially when you talk about representation of minorities, there is always a political aspect, a celebration that could be criticized. And that's why it's temporary, because you have other realities that are in relation to this one. Something is temporary doesn't mean that it doesn't have an impact on the long term. It just means that it's happening, you know, for about 10 days, for instance, when we were in Poland. And for a lot of citizens, this is not how their city looks like throughout the year. So this is just a moment into the city. This is a moment also for the citizen. This is a moment also for the tourists or the people who will visit the festival. It's autonomous also because, you know, you can create this romantic version of the city as well. This is really what I experienced when I was, for instance, in Murcia, or even I remember in Montreal when you go Orientalis. So they decided to have it. So this is the summer version of the Festival du Monde Arabe. So in terms of the space, it's very disconnected from the city. There is this idea of recreation, of spaces as well. So there's a certain it's completely detached from the rest of the city, but it's also connected. So this idea of autonomy. And so even if it's temporary and autonomous, I really believe that you have a longer impact on the space as well, and also on the people who will come. But it's very also important to look at it at this moment and the space that is detached from the everyday reality of the space, and of also the citizen and the tourist will come.
To better witness, I guess, its impact and understand that temporary does not mean that it's ephemeral, that it has no reach or long-term impact or effect. Your festival experience in Poland, as you explained, was not your first one. And as you mentioned, you've done some important work on Sephardic culture and the career of the Jewish Moroccan composer Sami El Maghribi. It is a fascinating story, really, that connects Morocco to Canada and Quebec, a story that connects the Festival des Andalousies Atlantiques de Sawira to the Festival Sepharad de Montréal. So can you tell me a bit about Sami El Maghribi and how his story, for example, gets told, retold, and reimagined at various festivals?
Yeah, so this is a fascinating story. I had the pleasure to work with my colleague Stephanie Schwartz on an exhibit in 2014, and our colleague Christopher Silver, who is a historian and now professor at McGill, who just published a fascinating, wonderful book about the history of this generation of musician, of Jewish musician from North Africa and their contribution to the music industry from, you know, around the 40s until the 60s. So the name of the book is Recording History, and it's the published by Stanford University Press, just came out.
It's on my reading list.
Yes, I highly recommend, you know, this book and his wonderful work about the history of Sami El Maghribi. So we worked together, and more specifically with the Montreal Jewish Museum in 2014 to, I would say, celebrate Sami El Maghribi's life. And it was at the moment of the Charter of Value in Quebec, so the tension between secularism and religiosity, and also to think about Arabness and Jewishness. And Sami El Maghribi is part of this generation that completely just expressed the fact that Jews were speaking in Arabic and not Judeo-Arabic, but they were part of Arabic culture and were performing Arabness as Jews, with Jews, Muslim, and sometimes also some, you know, Christian on stage. It depends on the performance. And what is for me the most fascinating is that when I started my research on the public representation of Sephardicness, or I would say not only North African, but Jews from the Muslim world in the mid-2000s, a lot of this representation in public spaces in France and even in Canada and in Spain, or even in Poland at that time for the Jewish festival, the way we talked about this music was connected to Judeo-Spanish music, to Spain, medieval Spain, and to a revival of Jewish music in Judeo-Spanish. Everything that was connected to Arabness or to the Arab culture of Jews were putting on the side. So it was not something that was celebrated. And even I remember meeting Sandra Bessis and Marlène Samoun, two amazing singers in France, or even Françoise Attant, so three important singers in France. And they used to perform extension in Judo-Spanish, but they were all from North Africa. So they're Jewish origin was also connected to Arabness and also to this Berber identity, to Amazigh culture, but it was not presented that way. And they were not embracing also this repertoire. And throughout time, I would say, started in the early, you know, 2010, the revival, or I would say the celebration of Judeo-Arabic culture started to emerge. And the work, for instance, of composer like Sami El Maghribi started to be reproduced because he had a lot of recordings, but kind of new edition of this his music. And the way it was presented was as Judeo-Arabic, les trésors de la musique judéo-arabe, for instance, the treasures of Judeo-Arabic culture. But the entire work of Sami El Maghribi, and more specifically, the way he was celebrated, was not for Judeo-Arabic music. He was born in Morocco, and then he was celebrated across, you know, North Africa. And then in the 60s, also in France and in the Moroccan or Algerian diaspora across, you know, the Francophone world, but then also in Israel. And a lot of people were listening to his pop music in Arabic. He also, you know, he knew Judeo-Arabic, but he was known for his contribution to Arabic music and to Moroccan nationalist, you know, music. So the fact that when I discovered this really emerging revival of this music in the early 2010 in France, for instance, and then progressively also in Canada, Israel is another topic. It was presented as Judeo-Arabic, but in the reality, this was connected, his music was connected to Arabness. So, and it was also progressive, and there is a shift in the way we think about this representation of Jewishness in Arabic, that now, you know, it's amazing that the work of Christopher Silver just arrived, published now, because there is a platform, people are interested in this story, but this is not a new history, but the fact that now we are bringing it back on public spaces, I mean, I'm going to give the work, an example of the work of Nital Kayam, who is Amit Hai Cohen, who is her husband. So she's a singer, he's a pianist, and they both are from Moroccan descent and they live in Israel. And they're constantly invited in Morocco, but also in France. They were also invited in Poland to perform this music from North Africa. So Jewish musicians singing in Arabic, including, for instance, the work of Salman Maghribi. And it changes the narrative and the way we talk about Jewishness in public space, and also the role and the message and the politics of this music today. When you think sing in Judeo-Spanish, it's a different story because it's connected to Spain. So you have all this idea of Andalus, really thinking about the performance of Jewishness in Arabic has a different meaning today. This is something that interests me a lot, this shift and the revival of this music today, and what, you know, it can say about the past, but also the way we reenact the past.
And that's a shift and a reenactment that takes place oftentimes on festival stages, at least from my understanding of the work that you've been doing.
Yeah, this is one of the major platforms for those, you know, musicians to exist, because of the politics also of a lot of festival, a lot of those public representation. I'm just going to give an example. So recently I've been in touch with some people in, you know, involved in the Festival des Cultures Juives of Paris, a Jewish cultural festival in Paris. And I thought about this work of a colleague of mine who is a musicologist, Jeremy Lockwood, who revived this this music from the early 20th century, we call cantorial music. And so this is a new generation of cantors. And in this revival, I thought it would be very interesting to have such event in the context of France. And because I'm always in touch with l'Institut Européen des Musiques Juives in Paris. So I thought it would be amazing to have them for a festival, because it's really Jewish music. And it's the revival of this Jewish music. And then the response from certain, you know, people over there told me that it might not be appropriate because it resonates with religiosity, because it's cantors who would be on stage. And because of the laïcité and secularism, the way we present Jewish culture cannot be through the lens of rituals or this image of religiosity. It has to be more secular Jewish culture. Well, in the context of Poland, it's completely different. You know, they embrace, you know, they love, you know, this Hasidic or this image of religiosity. And I would say it was the same also. I remember Festival du Monde Arabe in Montreal, where the Festival de Clôture, I think it was the edition of 2012, it was the opposite. They wanted to show the religiosity. So you had a cantor, you had a Jewish figure, Muslim figure, and Christian, all of them singing, you know, religious song, but also embracing religiosity on stage. That was to contradict the political discourse. But in France, they needed to reinforce because also of public funding. You know, when I think about the politicization of this music, it's always the challenge for people organizing or, you know, promoting and programming. How are they going to challenge the political discourse or, you know, the mainstream expectations of who's going to give funding? Do you want to push the boundaries? Do you want to stay within the boundaries? But, you know, music festival And first of all, in general, it's a lot of money. It costs a lot. You know, if you want to be creative and to challenge certain narratives, and I believe that a lot of festival and music festival have done it. And they're always trying to navigate or to negotiate between this need of responding to certain political need, but also to challenge it.
Yeah. I mean, this is a good place to ask my next question, which is about curating for change. It really speaks to what you were just describing there. As you know, we are recording this interview as part of a conference titled Curating for Change, the work that music festivals do in the world. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts about how this practice of curating for change evolved on festival stages or what form it takes at some of the festivals that you have been studying. So again, for listeners, so there was the Festival des Andalousies Atlantiques de Sawira, the Festival Sepharad de Montréal, and more recently, Krakow Jewish Festival, Cultural Festival in Poland.
You know, when I always think about changes or social changes, I always think about the role of individuals. And this is where I want to start to respond to your question. You know, any kind of institution always need to think about who are the actors, who are the people deciding what is going to happen, who's going to be on stage, and how they're going to be on stage. So of course you have the agent and you have the agency of artists who are sometimes they know what they can say or what they have to say. There are certain expectations from them. So really thinking about social change in terms of the role of individual and the interactions between the individuals. And I think when you look at certain festival, where I did a biography of the Festival Sepharad, and it was very interesting to see how, you know, the change of leadership of the festival completely changed the image of this festival as well. And then who they're going to look at, who are the artists, what are also the collaboration they decided to invest in, you know, with which politicians in the city or also the sit-which program. So you have a lot of different factors also. Poland had this new law where you cannot talk about the implication of Poland during the Holocaust has a direct impact on, you know, programming. So if you want to talk about controversial topic, you know, this is not something that, for instance, if you ask for funding that you can bring to the table, or there are certain speakers that you know you won't be able to have. There's a lot of artists that you cannot have. Again, you know, so many different elements that are part of the conversation to think about social change. So the role of the individual, the politics behind, and the economy as well that is connected to this economy. I really believe that it takes a lot of courage from organizers. You know, sometimes it's very comfortable when you, especially at the beginning, usually beginning of festival, you know, before it becomes so popular. And this is the example of the Krakow Jewish Cultural Festival. It was kind of underground at the beginning because, you know, to talk about Jewish cultures 25 years ago, 35 years ago in Poland, it was very different than it is today. And same thing in Morocco, you know, the way we talk about Jewish culture and Jewish-Muslim relationship in Morocco is very different today than it was 25 years ago. So it took a lot of courage. And then progressively, when you have a certain renommé, you know, you're well-known internationally, you have a certain image, you become mainstream. And what do you do when you become mainstream? Are you still able to make some changes or you just become the establishment? So this is always, you know, this tension or thinking about social changes when you are already mainstream or when you are mainstream, what are you able to do? So it's a dynamic. I mean, to respond to your question, it's really thinking about change. It's a dynamic element. And I think it's very important to really look at what is happening on the ground. And this is why ethnography is so important to think about social change and also cultural changes to bring new sounds and connected to those sounds, new narratives, like the fact that today it's possible to have Samil Malagarbi celebrated.
So building on your answer in this previous question, so you said that you've written an institutional biography or biography of the Festival Sepharad de Montréal. How do you see the future of a music festival such as the Festival Sepharad de Montréal? Or more generally, what does history or ethnography tell us about the work that diasporic festivals can, but also should do in the future?
I think the question, you know, and for a lot of artists, this is the question of economy. You know, how do you make money? How are you able to continue? And I think a lot of organizers have the same challenge. And in terms of the future, I would say that the big question is also connected to the future of the humanities and the arts, you know, and who is putting money on it. You know, the politics of the arts in, and I see in terms of music education as well in North America and in Europe is completely different. What you are able to accomplish in terms of making social changes with the arts is very different because it's a question, it's an economic question. And when you have public funding, it's very different than when you deal with private donors, for instance, where private donors, usually they have much more control. They want, not saying that public funding do not have that. Of course they do. And you can see, you know, for instance, depending on the election, then, you know, some programs or they will cut in culture, you know, the country. So you have the politics behind all this this economy of the art. So I would say that thinking about the future of music festival has to be, you know, also connected to the future of the arts and how it has to be in dialogue and in connection with what is happening also on an everyday basis. Because if we don't have musicians, if we don't invest in those artistic space, what exactly is going to be those music festivals? Today, it's very easy. You stay at home, you can compose from your home studio, but to have live music is a very different experience. And we all know that, but it needs, you know, investment. And here, this is at multiple level. So, you know, I'm at the School of Foreign Service and I'm teaching music globalization, international affairs. And though I hope that the students who potentially will work in politics will think about the importance of those spaces and not as only a fetish, you know, like it's just about representation, but it's also about making meaningful impact on the life of a lot of people. It's called soft power, you know. But, you know, I hate this term, even if I teach about this idea of soft power. But it's true that if you think about the war in Ukraine or nuclear bomb, this is a very different reality than thinking about playing the violin. But, you know, on the other hand, recently or in my class, for instance, we have a discussion about somebody who survived genocide in Cambodia and also during the Holocaust and, you know, music were able to keep them alive. Of course, it's one story, but we need to remember that. We need to remember about the power and also the danger. You know, Guantanamo, for instance, the way music has been used for torture. About the power, positive and negative, and also the possibility of those festivals to create and music at large to create conflicting dialogue without necessarily using words.
So that was Jessica Rota joining us via Zoom from Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. What is the work that music festivals do in the world? Could music festivals spark changes in behaviors or institutions? What about policies or even ways of being? Please join us for our online conference featuring artists, scholars, practitioners, and organizers. Co-hosted by the University of Guelph and Queen's University, Curating for Change, the Work That Music Festivals Do in the World is an online conference that will take place on October 14th and 15th. To find out more, visit whatmusicfestivalsdo.ca.